Moss, to give you a heads up, the other group didn't discuss the reversal of goodwill. And given we had some fairly decisive views on that, I think we might just start with that and deal with that first of all, if that's okay with you, get your feedback on that topic.
Sorry, Nick, should I start? I was...
Yeah, not just yet. I'm just going to give you a heads up. The other group didn't manage to discuss the reversal of goodwill.
Yeah.
And given that we had some fairly concise and decisive comments on that, we might just get that one out of the way to begin with. And then, so I may just start with you on that one before we start working through the two topics, just to warn you. I think we're waiting for a few people to come back from the other group. So.
Just on that, Nick, I'm a bit confused. Are we not going to get annual goodwill amortization back or not? The last you told me was that it's really on the agenda. I think you're on mute. Oh.
I think he's deliberately on mute.
It's not on the agenda for anything. So the board's preliminary view is to retain the status quo of the impairment model, but clearly the board, that was by a narrow majority, 8-6. So the board is inviting views in the discussion paper on this subject, and particularly focused on any new arguments. I think, you know, this topic's been discussed endlessly, and so that's where we are. It's effectively out for consultation.
Thanks.
So, just waiting to see. Tim, was Rika leading your session?
That was just Craig's session. Martin was on mine.
Sorry, apologies. Craig, was Rika on your session? Was she leading that?
Yeah, it doesn't look like Craig or Rika have joined yet.
Right, okay.
I believe Rika was running the session.
Yeah. Okay. And we're still waiting for a couple of other members to come across. I can see Rika now. And Craig. So we will just give it 1 minute. Well, let me just explain how this element's going to work. So what we will do is that we're going to run through topic by topic. So we've got three topics altogether. I know group two concentrated on the first two topics. And I was saying to Martin, given that our group had some fairly decisive views on the question, the third topic of goodwill, reversal of goodwill impairments, we might just deal with that first before we launch into the other two. Okay. So Martin, if I pass over to you to begin with.
Yes, thanks, Nick. So we just had only 3 or 4 minutes to discussing really if a reversal of goodwill impairment is useful. And there was, I think, from GPF members on and CMAC members, a clear signal that it is not any value in doing that. And people said, okay, this up and down of values would not really be helpful, and especially okay to tracking set would be very costly, and to measure set is very difficult, which kind of doing with value in use or whatever. Then I think the segments or the levels where you measure set okay maybe have changed. So it was clearly a clear no to this kind of idea of isn't reversal of an impairment of goodwill and good idea, and has that led maybe to the problem too little, too late of goodwill impairment. So it was both CMAC and GPF members said, Clo, that would not be a good idea to invite reversal of goodwill impairment.
Okay.
I'm sorry for a group to name that, to share your thought on this question, the last topic.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Martin. So I suggest we move on to the other two topics. And Rika, why don't you kick us off with the discussion around location of information then?
Topic one, right? So firstly, from the GPF member, I think they estimate and quantitate the synergy of especially cost rather than revenue. But what I heard from the user side, CMAC member, they value the information about the synergy of cost synergy, but also they're really interested in the revenue synergy as well. But prepare a GPS member share their concern about auditability or commercial sensitivity of the revenue information in terms of the synergy. And then, yes, and the user side, they are more interested in the information about the subsequent performance of the synergy. So they will be pleased to have the tracking information, how the synergy is working well in the future years, not only the information about the synergy at the purchase the year, the entity purchased those businesses. That kind of thing I heard, and this is a kind of the very brief summary. So I want to welcome anyone would like to add.
Just bear with me. So that was the first topic that your group discussed, which was the disclosures about synergies. Is that correct?
Okay.
Just so we're all doing this on the same page. So before we open up, Martin, would you like to summarize what we heard from our group on the disclosures about synergies?
Yeah, and it was a kind of, do people really estimate synergies to also say, okay, that to price building, that is an element to defend the price? And I think from the preparers we heard, it depends. Man, in most situations, maybe it is, and some it is not, and kind of element. Some people said, man, usually in big acquisitions, what people are doing is to estimate synergies. That maybe that is not always done by finance people, it's done by M&A people. Maybe they are not, quality of that information is not maybe so robust. Then we heard a kind from preparer saying, okay, that it is easier to estimate revenue synergies instead of cost synergies. We heard that quite often. And we heard from users that say maybe would rely more on cost synergies than on revenue synergies. So it was a kind of a little bit opposite in this kind of element of that. And clearly, have people, especially users, heard about synergies? Yes, but it is really kind of issue that companies from time to time speaking about synergies, they also speak about, okay, how these synergies have developed. But the concern is that if that is good news, maybe they continue to give that disclosure. If it is bad news, so the synergies have not developed as expected, this information is not given. And therefore, I think it's information is essential, and if it should be reliable, I think users have said, okay, it should be mandatory in the financial statements. And I think what we heard summary from preparers is yes, in many cases they do an estimate. Are that good estimates? It depends, I would say. Is it difficult? Yes, it is difficult. And even the reporting of the synergies, I think, is difficult when it comes to integration, and also that maybe isn't a reason why information about disclosure of revenue of synergies ended, because businesses are integrated and therefore it is difficult then to track what is the exact amount of synergies.
Great, thank you. And there were a couple of other things that interested me from our group. One, I think both a preparer and a user, and it goes back to what you were saying, Martin, emphasize the importance of separating out cost and revenue synergies. rather than just a synergy number. And also something that I hadn't appreciated is that today, often these numbers are found in analyst presentations, but these presentations seem to disappear and almost evaporate, and very hard to get back to that information historically. So let me now open it up to CMAC and GPF members if there's any points that were made in your group that you'd like to emphasize, or any observations from what you've heard from the other groups. Please alert me in the chat so I can call on you to speak. So everyone happy that that was a comprehensive summary, then it sounds like, of the discussion we had. Okay, if there are no further comments on that, I suggest then we move on to the other topic, which was around the location of the information and the subsequent performance of acquisitions. And I should clarify, because it just goes back to what I think we were saying about, partly related to what we're saying about synergies. I think, what, if I recall correctly, what we proposed in the discussion paper is that synergies should be disclosed, the expected synergies should be disclosed at the time of the acquisition, but in certainly how you subsequently monitor that acquisition, that is a decision for, would be a decision for each preparer to decide the metric there to monitor that acquisition. It wouldn't necessarily have to be synergies, but it could be synergies if that's what you decided. So I think much of the debate we certainly had in our group, Martin, was around, where is the information found today? What's the appropriate place for this information? Is it in the financial statements? Is it management commentary? So perhaps you could summarize what we heard.
Yes, thanks, Nick. I think so. First of all, say, okay, we discussed, okay, is currently, okay, do companies provide this kind of information of subsequent performance of what was expected from the targets of an acquisition? And sometimes I think we heard, okay, it is voluntarily disclosed, but not in financial statements, maybe also not so often in management commentary, maybe is in different other places, but not so in the financial statement, but also not in management commentary. And what is the proper location? Because we got a clear message from, I think, CMAC members. I think this kind of information, I think, is essential for governance decision making, and because, okay, a lot of money is spent, and then said, okay, what really is the performance of this, for this money spent, is that giving, I think, is an essential information, and therefore this essential information is should be given by management, and therefore the location in the financial statement should be the right place, because if we would only require it in management commentary, I think the fear was that many companies would not follow this advice, and maybe also not, maybe then it is a kind of bad information, would not add that in their management commentary. There was quite a debate of would this kind of disclosure, like we have seen it many years ago, is about executive remuneration, would that really also change behavior? And we had some people say, okay, that would help, because, okay, this, if companies are aware that they have to disclose the kind of subsequent performance of this kind of information, that maybe would improve decision making before they make this decision about an acquisition. We had quite a long debate about that. And what else? I think we discussed, okay, would it kind of, if the board would not make it mandatory in the financial statement, we have some noise. No, it's better. Where do I stop? I said, okay, or would it helpful, okay, if we would maybe add a kind of requirement in our management commentary practice statement, which we all know is not mandatory, but it would help engage or motivate really companies to then add this kind of information in their management commentary, and maybe it would helpful, but there was a clear message that in many cases that would not change behavior from preparers. So if we want to have to change that, that should be in the financial statements. And then we had this kind of, that's often this information is difficult to portray, difficult to get. But as I said, and Nick also explained, I think our proposal is not that in all kind of cases, if you have to say, you don't track this information, clearly you don't have to make it up, and then you don't have to present it. So I think that is what I have on my summary.
Yeah. Thanks, Martin. That's great. Rika, over to you. I think you're mute, Rika.
Sorry, I was on mute. And I think most members are from the both DPA and CMAC mentioned that due to the nature of the information, this kind of information might be more appropriate to be disclosed in management commentary. But at the same time, especially CMAC member commented that because board has no specific tool to put some kind of the disclosure in management commentary, because many jurisdictions have different rules over what to be disclosed within the management commentary. So there is a kind of the question of availability of the information about the subsequent performance of acquisition. But also, if some information of the subsequent performance can be included in within the financial statement, in that case, that information will be subject to audit as part of the financial statement audit. That give more that raise the level of the assurance covered those information. And then also I had one of the recommendation, I mean a suggestion from the CMAC member is it may be possible for us to consider the improvement on the disclosure, especially about the assumption of impairment test that can be possible within the financial statement, and that refinement might help investor to understand the future performance of the acquired business. That's a quite brief summary from my side.
Thank you, Rika. So again, can I invite either CMAC or GPF members, if there are points or comments, reactions to what you heard from the other group that you would like to make now, just to drop a message into the chat, and we can take it from there. Okay, thank you. Florian, let's start off with you.
Thanks, Nick. I think one of the discussions we've had, which I thought was interesting, there was less of a discussion about do preparers have the data, because I think the comment from one of the preparers was we feel it it's our duty to have these data to actually prepare the valuation for the acquisition itself. The question is more, under what type of assurances do we want to publish that data? Right, and how much is sensitive from a commercial point of view? But I don't think there ever was a discussion on do they have the data or not, but more how would they want to publish it. And I think this kind of comes back to the general topic, how much is there a disconnect between the data that is being published in the financial statements and the data that the company itself is being run on. And I think it's one of these topics as well here.
Okay. That's an interesting perspective. Thanks. Paul?
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, very briefly, I'd just make the simple point that has been said, but I think it's worth saying again, you know, requiring this in management commentary would mean it wouldn't be required because the management commentary is only guidance from the board and so doesn't have the same status. So if we want to require it, it has to be in financial statements. It's as simple as that. And my view is it needs to be required in order for us to get the information that we ought to be having. And so there is only one possible answer to this question. It needs to be in the financial statements.
Okay, thank you. I think that's where we landed also in our group. Liliana, over to you.
Yes, thank you. I have two comments relating to the location, and I say that in the group I want to share to all of you. The first one is that what is the role of the financial statements versus the role of the management commentary? And what are the limits of the legal environment where those different informations or reports are working? In Europe in general and in France in particular, the management commentary is stated by the law. It is a clear engagement and responsibility of the board of directors to provide such a management, and the role of the financial statement is the tool to do these comments. So this is a problem to substitute the management commentary with the financial statement, because the main role is relating to the management commentary relating to the communication to the market. The second point is the audit of the information. We provide everything that you were discussing in this meeting. We would provide in the management commentary, and it is the management view, is the management appreciation of the things, et cetera, et cetera. But at what point this information can be auditable, can be audited? What is the assurance that we will provide to this information, and what would be the situation of the auditors relating to that? To audit a management commentary or management view, it's a very, very tricky situation. The third point is the timing of publication. The management commentary is something that is part, in France at least, is part of the communication, the press release to the market, is part of the management commentary. And this is issue at the press release. The financial statement, the only information that we provide with the press release is the fourth main financial statement. All the disclosures provided by the annex and notes are published 15 to 20 days after. And I wonder if it is... it is the intent of to provide a useful and timely information to the market if the financial statement are the right price. Those are my three comments relating to that.
Thanks, Liliana. And certainly in our consultation on the discussion paper, I hope that we get feedback from the assurance community in terms of, you know, their views on the audibility of that. That's clearly a key issue. I think the timeliness is an interesting question. But in my experience, and be interesting to hear from others, lots of investors will certainly spend time analysing a company's M&A activity, perhaps before making a decision first to invest in a company. And so it doesn't necessarily need to be produced immediately with the numbers to have that record there so I can go back part of my initial analysis to understand management's thinking at that time, the parameters around that deployment of capital. I think would be very helpful. And as James mentioned in our group, certainly where this information is found in analyst presentations, often rather than management commentary, maybe may be different in France, that information just seems to disappear and the presentations cease to exist and can't be accessed. So this would provide at least a record that one could definitively go back to. But I hear what you say, and certainly for some investors, there would be an issue around the timeliness. So thank you for that comment. Sandy, over to you.
I just wanted to respond to a comment that was made, and the comment implied that there would always be synergies. And one of the things we discussed in our group was that it really depends on the nature of the acquisition. You can have acquisitions that are really more like a asset acquisition where you don't expect synergies, or you may not get any employees or anything along with the acquisition. And so I think you have to think broader and make and any standard setting in this area would need to be flexible enough to handle different situations.
I think that's an excellent point, Sandy. And certainly when the board came to think about subsequent performance of acquisitions, it did discuss and agreed that deals are done for many different reasons. And that's why management should choose the measure of subsequent performance rather than the board say it will be this or it will be something else. And indeed, the proposed disclosure around synergies is only those expected at the time of the transaction. And clearly, if there aren't any, that we should make it clear that's the answer. There aren't any. And there's no point making things up to satisfy a requirement. But I think it's a very good point that the transactions are done for many different reasons. James, you wanted to add something.
I really want to add that I probably didn't explain this very well when Martin was chairing. I would always treat the synergy calculations with some skepticism because of extraneous factors, as I said at the time. But the thing that is really of value to me that would just save a lot of time and would enable me or other investors to judge the value of the acquisitions of a company is a record of how much was spent, how much equity financed, how much net debt impact, cash outflow versus debt raised, and how much for that year's acquisition was the eventual goodwill impairment. And would go back 5 years line by line, similar to how an insurer, a P&C insurer discloses accident years. So you go 5 years, this is how much we spent in that year, how much equity, how much debt and net cash outflow. And just that would really be something that would be involve less judgment. But I think the point that Ian from Roche made is that the problem with that is what happens if you have asset acquisitions rather than legal entity acquisitions. That we have to think about. But that is where I would see, and that would be in the financial statements to me, not in MD&A.
Thanks, James. Doug, you're next.
Yeah, just on the type of information that will go in there, it's very much forward-looking, and it's very much, call it estimate and range to the extent of what's being asked for. So when we actually go from a legal perspective and from a investor perspective, I assume then in the financial statements we'll be allowed to put in forward-looking statements that say any investor that uses those forward-looking statements does it at their own risk, because they may not come to fruition. And when we do business cases, they're on ranges. There's not an exact number to revenue synergies or cost synergies. There's a range and a probability associated with it. And some of the safe harbor language that we use in our management disclosures will have to be interpreted into the financial statements again. And I do think the auditors, and I do hopefully to your point, they jump into this conversation, because I'd be surprised if they could actually give you anything beyond, we tied it to management's estimate. Like, what assurance levels could they possibly do that is going to give any kind of comfort to some of these numbers that we're looking at? And so I still see it very, very problematic to me in the financial statements. And I would even, you know, go to at what point is it from a competitive perspective, from an estimate perspective, and even in our group, all of the analysts suggested that they don't like M&A and they're going to discount everything we disclose anyway. But it kind of seems interesting that we want a lot of disclosure that's not going to be used, it's going to be discounted anyway. How different is that than what they're doing now? And putting in the financial statements with that risk profile, to me, we do definitely need to then change the audit report, change the risk disclosures, and change the forward-looking statement.
Thanks, Doug. Glenn, you wanted to make a comment. You're on mute, Glenn. Still can't hear you, I'm afraid. Okay, still can't hear you. Glenn, we'll try coming back to you in a moment. Anthony, you wanted to make a comment. We'll try and then get back to Glenn.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, perfect.
Anthony, yeah.
I'll just say a quick comment as a follow-up there to Doug's comment. I was in the same group. I don't think we would, or at least I'll speak for myself, so I don't confuse the situation. The analysts question whether, you know, acquisitions add value just because we're skeptical, and studies show that many have been problematic, and history shows that too. All that said, having detail and information related to synergies provided in the note disclosures, and I suggested in our meeting that we include that in areas where we have goodwill impairment disclosure, because as part of the future cash flow projections and assumptions, that would be a key assumption that would likely have been built into that. So providing where the movement in that assumption what has been over the last 12 months, let's say, in the disclosure would be very important, and then could capture both issues that we want to address. Then that would help analysts who are typically skeptical, but that's that we have to be, and then allow us to evaluate how the acquisition has gone. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear. Thanks.
Thanks, Anthony. Let's try Glenn again. No, that's still not. Hello? Yes, that's
any
good.
Any better?
Yes, we have you.
Any better?
Yes. We can hear you, Glenn.
Can you hear me? Oh, good. Well, I can't see you, but I just wanted to come back to the point that Doug was making there. And I think it's important that we don't misunderstand what it is that we in the market are looking for when we ask for the disclosures about M&A. I don't think we're looking for forecasts of what will actually happen. I think, or at least that's not the only reason. One of the reasons that this matters is because the market's trying to make an evaluation of two things. One is, what is the quality of the decision-making of management? And second is, what is the risk that the investor's taking when he invests in that management, in that company? And it's perfectly fair for management to say, there is a range of outcomes, and this is where we think is the most likely outcome, or this is why we're doing it, given that. And the wider that range, the bigger the standard deviation of the outcomes, the less certain the transaction is. Now, right now, it's very hardly any of that information about the range of outcomes and the certainty of the transaction is made available to investors. But I think one of the reasons why these disclosures become important is precisely because they force management to come back to the market with questions like the one that, that Doug is raising, which is that these are inherently uncertain. And that, I think, is a very helpful thing to say. And the only question then is, how uncertain is the transaction? So there's two things going on here, or several things going on here. One is clearly everybody wants to know the path of future profits for valuation purposes. The other is that people want to know the quality of decision-making and what inputs are going into that decision-making. Are there the systems to be able to capture the relevant information? Is the acquisition being monitored in the right time scale, in the right time period? Depends on how big it is. And thirdly, what is the risk that is being taken by the investors? And I think the management really owes people some explanation, for the investors some explanation on that, depending on how big the transaction is.
Thanks, Glenn. That was very clear once we got to hear you. Could we now go to Ian?
Yeah, thanks. I think it's the more I listen to this, actually, the more it sort of starts to crystallize my views. I think this topic seems to me rather more about sort of governance and about management and about the quality and necessarily about sort of debits and credits. And I look again to what's done on executive remuneration. IS 19 is actually itself is pretty light on exec remuneration disclosures. It very much looks to what's in the regulatory environment. And then that depends on the local regulators. In Switzerland, we have a very extensive executive remuneration report, which is subject to a specific review report from an audit firm. It strikes me if we're looking to somehow hold management account for spending large chunks of the shareholders' money, whether it's on an M&A deal, whether it's on a CapEx project, whether you're spending the money on a big joint venture or whatever, rather than just the narrow definition of a BizCom per IFRS 3, you maybe want to be thinking about some kind of equivalent to the exec remuneration report, get the regulators in the different jurisdictions at least to somehow align on this. You could put a requirement for some audit report on top of that, and then you'd have consistency also across the world. The risk of putting in the financial statements among many others is if you're putting it into IFRS, what are the people in using US GAAP going to do? Because there'll be a certain unhappiness from preparers using IFRS if we're giving all this information and folks using US GAAP or other accounting standards aren't doing the same thing. So I think it's maybe a wider topic, and just pushing it into the IFRS financial statement strikes me as sort of the wrong answer to the right question.
That's certainly an interesting perspective, and we've heard that before in terms of why just for M&A, why not large CapEx? In terms of US GAAP, clearly can't speak for FASB, but we know that they're clearly monitoring our project here, and as we would monitor theirs. So how that pans out in the fullness of time, it's difficult to say. So let me just check. Are there any further contributions on anything you've heard, any of the feedback issues? Doesn't seem to be. Could I just ask the staff then? I do have a couple of Anthony first and then Bertrand. Anthony.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Cool. Just a comment then on that. I would say that, I think I just lost my train of thought, if you can imagine that. I'm gonna come back. Sorry.
Try Bertrand first, and then we'll give you a last crack at it. But Bertrand?
Yeah, yes, thank you. Only one short comment about the location of information about the performance of an acquisition. That just to bear in mind that for the financial statements are key, and that we need to have audited financial statements, and we understand that this is the case.
So this means that any information that is inside the financial statement should be, of course, audited. And because this provides some, better reliability of this information and better so that the analysts and users can use this information. Just bear in mind that auditability is key to provide confidence in this information. And I understand that performance acquisition might be difficult in that case sometimes to report, but anyway, we need to have reliable information.
Thank you, Bertram. Anthony. Have your thoughts come back?
Listen, I must be early. It's early in the morning here for me. I haven't had enough coffee. So it's back to the point about IFRS and FASB, because I think that's important. I mean, we battle with all that here in Canada all the time, all our companies, debating should they report IFRS or should they report US GAAP, et cetera. And especially even clients struggling to read the financial statements. And my comment would be, I think we have to move forward with our rules and our standards. Even when FASB and the ISB has worked together, they haven't come to the same conclusions. There's a number of examples of that, and that's just recently. Okay, we can go IFRS 9, we can go 16, 15. I mean, so I think that's not the stumbling block. We're here to make sure that we're providing the best quality information for the users of IFRS statements. And I think when FASB sees that there's a good additional information that would help users, they'll take the same type of action if they can get it passed. So I don't want that to be a stumbling block. Just thought I'd make that comment.
Great. Thanks, Anthony. Tim, can I just ask, have you got everything you need? I think we've had a fairly good feedback session.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's been very useful. Lots of comments there that we've captured from both sessions on all the topics. So it's been really useful. So if I can thank GPF and CMAP members for those comments, they've been great.
Great. Thanks. Well, thanks, everyone. I suggest what we do now is actually break as per the timetable. So we'll break until 1:15. So if you're quick, you may just get time for a sandwich and then reconvene back on the main platform, to discuss primary financial statements. So breaking until 1:15 London time. Thank you.